Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to talk about how a nutrient in blueberries and grapes can be effective in helping your lungs and prevent your lungs from aging prematurely, the Sabin Research Institute in Los Angeles. And then sugar's tipping point. It's linked to Alzheimer's disease from the University of Bath, which is in the United Kingdom, meaning when you take too much, what happens? Also, we're going to look at if you were to eat, according to this latest study from Imperial College London, 10 portions of fruits and vegetables a day, we could have 7.8 million people not dying prematurely. Wow. Now, when I was going to dietetic school, it was 4 portions to 5 portions. I suggest 20 portions now, but not necessarily having to eat them, juicing them or in concentrated powders, because the more you consume, the better it is for you. So we'll deal with that. Also today, fruits and vegetable-rich diet is linked to a much lower risk of chronic lung disease, or what is known as COPD, from the Karolinska Institute in Sweden. And also today, berries from the Tibetan Himalayas have, quote, great functional food potential, according to the Chinese Academy of Sciences. And if you're incarcerated, you have a greater risk of cancer, McMaster's University and St. Michael's Hospital in Canada. Then today, from our audio file, I'm going to play a clip, The Deep State Hiding in Plain Sight, with a congressional staff member for 28 years, Mike Lofgren, L-O-F-G-R-E-N, on Bill Moyer's program. And Moyers talks about Washington's deep state in which elected and unelected figures collude to protect and serve powerful vested interest. Quote, it is how we have had deregulation, financialization of the economy, the Wall Street bust, the erosion of all civil liberties, and perpetual war. Also today, for those of you who do not believe that the CIA is a nefarious organization and support the idea that they should be leaking documents that embarrass Trump, just remember, it is a very nefarious organization. And if they could leak documents on Trump or prevent him from getting information, imagine what they could do for Chris Hedges or Cornel West or Glenn Ford, Riley Bailey, and some of the others. Glenn Greenwald will be giving us a short but scathing rebuttal to the CIA, saying, quote, it is designed to disseminate propaganda. And also, with all this going on, this great love fest between our current president, Donald Trump, and Netanyahu, who's under multiple criminal investigations at this moment in Israel. And by the way, I will say this to the credit of the Israeli people and its government. They have found multiple powerful people guilty of crimes and sentenced them, and many, including a former president of the government, went to prison. You don't see that in America. It's just never done. That's the power of the deep state. But what we do not hear are responsible spiritual voices in the mainstream media. They certainly exist, talking about you're not going to have peace until you stop oppression. I have a friend that works quietly behind the scenes, helping the Vatican and also helping, he is a devout Christian, Catholic, but he is working also in Israel. And recently in a conversation, he said, long ago, so much of what is causing problems in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict could have stopped if they would have simply allowed what he and some others wanted to do, have a building zone in Gaza and in the West Bank that would allow the citizens of Gaza and the West Bank, the Palestinian people, to have factories and businesses and be able to create and export around the world and give them prosperity. He said, you know what it means when people have a good standard of living, have food, have good schools they can send their children to, and are not living in conflict? There will always be provocateurs, as there are within the Palestinian movements, as well as there are in the Israeli movement. So today, until we address these issues, we're not going to get any further along. And unfortunately, Donald Trump, in my personal opinion, is the type of person that is not willing to look deeply into the history of any conflict to see what have been the precipitating factors, contributing conditions. So we're going to have someone on who will give us a perspective on this, and who was a leading Zionist, one of the foremost, Sir Gerald Kaufman. He was also a member of parliament, and his grandmother died in the Holocaust, and he does not want Israelis murdering Palestinians. He wants peace. I thought he is a measured person, a person who is pro-Israel and pro-Jewish, but also pro a proper approach to peace. So we'll have some of these different voices today. I don't know how many of these I'll be able to get on because there's a lot of program we have to do, but we'll get many. So let's begin, and we'll go over these issues one by one. First up, we should be having way more fruits and vegetables in the diet that we're having, and also ideally they should be organic wherever possible, locally grown. That helps the local economy and stops something from having to come from Washington State, like an apple, or maybe lettuce from California to New York or Boston, when we could be doing this locally. We should be investing in local farm co-ops. How does that work? Well, I'll give you an idea. It's relatively simple. I had the first in the eastern United States, by the way, the Fertiller Farm, and we started the High Falls Food Co-op. You get a piece of land, you get a farm that has not been sprayed, so it's certified organic, or not within 3 to 5 years, and ideally you want some slightly rolling terrain, so you get good runoff, and then you get a group of people who would like to support local farming, and they go in and they contribute to the person that owns the farm, and they get a contract. So in effect, you're investing in this person, so this person is actually also working for you. So let's say you get 10 people and they each invest $1,000 or $2,000. He's able then to build a greenhouse and maybe a 40 by a 20 foot greenhouse. And then he grows hydroponically. So now you're getting microgreens and vegetables, tomatoes and cucumbers, and maybe 20 different types of lettuces, plus sprouts, at least 40 types of sprouts. You're getting those, the vegetables hydroponically, you can grow in 1/3 the time. Instead of 90 days in the ground, it's 30 days in a tray. Plus you can get sprouts every 7 to 8 days and microgreens every 15 days to 20. So now, on a monthly basis, you're getting organic, locally grown produce that you're in a cooperative. You're one of the participants. It gives the farmer an income that they wouldn't have had. It allows the ground not to be eroded by constant monocrop. And now you can add to it. Let's say you want to have some fermented foods. So inside, he can start to do sauerkrauts and some misos. So you're getting a healthy, locally grown, fermented food, probiotics, very good for your digestion and the microbiota in your intestines. Then you say, let's get some fruit trees in here. So you get some 3-year fruit trees that stand about 6 foot tall, and then you space them approximately 20 feet apart, so they got plenty of room to grow, and you put them always on a ridge or a sloping hill so you get good drainage and you don't get rot. And then you fertilize that nice tree with the breakdown products of manures that you get from local stables, because stables always have a problem. What do we do with all this horse manure from riding stables or cow manure from pastures that are having them? And a lot of people have animals, by the way, that in fact on the road where my ranch for that many of you visited, the Healing Springs Ranch down in Tioga, Texas, there was a wonderful road that went bordered the property 200 acres down to Lake Ray Roberts. No one raised the animals for food. They raised them for tax exemptions. And so I would go down there, and I'd go in there once a month and clean up all the manures, bring them back, put them on manure piles, and then put the straw, hay, and shavings from the barn in on top of it, then food that you have not eaten on top of that. And very shortly thereafter, you have a nice, rich soil. So you really fertilize the plants. The healthier the fertilization, the healthier, the stronger the tree. It'll resist disease, it'll resist temperature changes, and you can always help keep a tree alive longer, especially a fruit tree, by hay baling the base. So when it gets cold, the base and the root where the life has to maintain stays warm enough to survive a cold winter. That's how I had my orchard upstate at the Fertiller Farm. And now you got fruits. And then you get local farmers to give you all their downs. Nobody wants fruit on the ground because it creates worms and creates an imbalance in the acidity of the soil, so you want to collect them all. And you collect them for no cost. Now you wash them, you dry them, you cut them, you have dried fruits, dried apples, peaches, plums, pears. Then you can dry anything you don't sell or don't use. Dry your string beans, dry your tomatoes. So you see, this is the idea of a food co-op done locally, so that you don't have to have that apple from, there's nothing wrong, great, having apples if you can't get them anywhere else from Oregon or Washington State or Colorado that has good orchards. But now you're growing your own, and you're doing it locally. And now you get another 10 people involved. Now you grow your own mushrooms. All of these things you can do locally, and it gives you an opportunity to have a healthier diet. Now, the more of these nutrients you bring into your body, the better your body's going to be, the healthier it's going to be, and that's what you want. So anyhow, it's just an idea that I have that if we had 1 million people starting to do this, they would be able to feed about 100 people each. So you're talking about 100 million people could be fed at no cost to the government, no cost to society, but enormous benefits. You see, we confuse the complexity of an issue and a problem with the simplicity of its solution. Now, can this be done? I've done it. I'm doing it now. So for the naysayers, then you haven't done your homework or you don't have the experience. But for those of us who are actually doing things, solving problems every single day, this is a no-brainer. Anyhow, we should be having a lot more fruits and vegetables in our diet, because the more fruits and vegetables you have, the longer you're going to live, the less disease you're going to have, the less cancer, less heart disease, less Alzheimer's, less arthritis. This is from the Sabin Research Institute in Los Angeles. Quote, Dr. Barbara Driscoll and colleagues demonstrated for the first time that inhaled resveratrol treatments slow age-related degeneration, changes in the mucus lining, and lung aging. That's characterized by the airspace enlargement and the decreasing lung function, and its significant risk factor for chronic human lung disease. This was published in Thorax. Quote, we believe that ours is the first study to demonstrate a beneficial effect of lung-directed resveratrol treatments on aging lung. Now, they're talking about resveratrol. Now, that's the chemical found in red wine in small amounts, maybe 5 milligrams, in grape juice, a lot more, maybe 30 milligrams, or as a supplement, about 150 milligrams, best of all. It's an antimicrobial chemical, and it's produced by plants to protect against infection and stress-related changes. And it was previously shown in more than 2,000 peer-reviewed scientific studies, its benefits to the body, but also its support muscle metabolism when you just take it orally. And it's extremely important. So for anyone with lung conditions, I suggest instead of doing the inhaling of it, which could be done with inhalers that they have with resveratrol, you could just take resveratrol. Now, from Bath, if you've never been to Great Britain, it's a wonderful country to visit. It has some absolutely great people. Love the British people. But it has these old towns and cities that we only see in movies. I was just watching one the other night, late at night. John Wayne and Maureen O'Hara, and in that John Ford movie, found out that he only paid $10 back in the 1930s for the story, and it took him 20 years, this great director, 20 years to finally get a studio to produce what was called The Quiet Man, about a man who shows up in his family's small village in Ireland, and he left there when he was a kid with his mom, went to the United States, became a boxer, and then his falling in love with this his neighbor, this Maureen O'Hara, and then the conflicts between them. It's for its time, it was made in the early 1950s. It was one of those kind of feel-good films that wouldn't be as politically correct today, because there was some statements in the movie or some things in the movie that people would say, well, you know, we're beyond that today. But what impressed me was the quaintness of the towns, how beautiful the countryside. I mean, you just don't get any more beautiful countryside than the Irish countryside, especially overlooking the ocean. And in England, you have Bath, B-A-T-H, beautiful town. If you ever go there, it's a must to visit. Well, there they found, in research at the University of Bath, for the first time, what is known as a tipping point. The molecular link between the blood sugar, glucose, and Alzheimer's disease. And it was established. And they'd shown that the excess glucose damages a vital enzyme involved with inflammation response in the early stages of Alzheimer's. Now, why is this important? Because most Americans and a lot of people in other countries, especially Great Britain, Scotland, Ireland, you have too much sugar. Even in drinking alcohol, you're breaking down the sugar. And so abnormally high blood sugar levels, or what is called hyperglycemia, is well known as a characteristic for diabetes and obesity, but they're now calling Alzheimer's type 3 diabetes, and they're able to prove it. Diabetes patients have an increased risk of developing Alzheimer's disease compared to healthy individuals, and in Alzheimer's disease, abnormal proteins aggregate to form plaques and tangles in the brain, which progressively damages the brain and leads to severe cognitive decline. Now, scientists already knew, this audience knows, that glucose and its breakdown products can damage proteins and cells via the reaction called glycation. You've heard me say how many times that visualize a plump, moist chicken being put into the oven, 2 hours later comes out brown and crisp. That's glycation. That's actually what happens when you have proteins and sugars. Now, it doesn't come from normal sugars, like in an apple, but it sure does come from all the fructose, high fructose corn syrup, and glucose and sucrose that we find added to our diet. So now we know that we're prematurely aging the brain every time we have these excess glucose molecules in our body. And now scientists from the University of Bath, Department of Biology and Biochemistry, Chemistry and Pharmacology, working with colleagues at the Wolfson Center for Age-Related Disease at King's College London, have unraveled that link. So that's good. So this was published in the peer-reviewed journal Science Scientific Reports. So here's the takeaway message. We currently have a minimum of 50 million people suffering from Alzheimer's disease. You probably have triple that who have cognitive decline. I see it in many of my friends, some in their 40s and 50s, depending upon how abused their body has been. And in virtually all of my friends who smoked and drank or did drugs, I saw it in their 40s. So you don't have to get old to have this happen. It's just depending upon how much exposure your body has had to oxidative stress and glycation. Sugar now has a tipping point, meaning like anything else. A good example would be my brother Howard. Every time I say, Howard, you shouldn't be smoking. You're smarter than that. He'd say, oh, you know, such and such smoked and lived to be 90. Yeah, and let me show you the 10 million people who tried and didn't make it. And so he didn't seem to have anything wrong, according to him, until one day he had terminal lung cancer. That's tipping. So there's a point to where your body cannot help you, and you tip. So now they found the tipping point for sugar tips as Alzheimer's. So for those of you who are overweight, you've heard me say many times, it is not humanly possible to be overweight and healthy. It isn't possible. Now you can say, but I went to the doctor, Gary, and they did every test, and I showed they did not do every test. They did not tell you the level of your oxidative stress. They did not tell you the level of your DNA damage and breaking the links. They did not tell you how your mitochondria are functioning in your brain. They did not show you whether you have specks of amyloid beta plaque in the brain or microstrokes in the brain. They did not tell you how much more difficult it is for a heart to pump blood. So you just got the basic SMAC24. You got some other tests, and those are only one part of the entire diagnostic procedure. So you're damaging yourself. And that's the excuse of people, well, I seem okay. Well, seeming is not seeing. You're not seeing the cells. For example, there's no study that can show us a million brain, liver, heart, muscle, and kidney cells dying with a glass of alcohol. There's no study, but we know it does. So get off that sugar. It's killing you. And by the way, another study from Yale University, published in JCI Insight, fructose, which I just mentioned is a form of sugar linked to obesity and diabetes, is converted in the human brain from glucose. Now, this is something new. We didn't know this before. And remember, fructose is a simple sugar. It's found in fruits and vegetables, but it's in the table sugar in processed form where it's most dangerous. And when you're consuming more than what the body can metabolize, fructose contributes to high blood sugar and chronic disease like obesity. But the Yale study has demonstrated in this that it actually is converted in the brain. That's not good. And that means that it could be hurting you. And from Imperial College in London, a fruit and vegetable intake above 5 a day shows major benefit in reducing the chance of heart attack, stroke, cancer, and early death. This is the finding of new research led by scientists from Imperial College, which analyzed 95 separate scientific studies on fruit and vegetable intake. And the team found that that they recommend 5 portions a day of fruits and vegetables. I'm recommending 20. They're way off. Now, it's good that they found this, that you could lower your risk. And this was a meta-analysis of 2 million people. And this was published in the International Journal of Epidemiology. But I'm saying they're understating it. We need a lot more. Now, what they have not done, they haven't worked with tens of thousands of people helping them reverse diseases. I have. And the more fruits and vegetables I'm getting people to eat, the more juices they're taking, the better it is in reversing those diseases. And finally, from the Karolinska Institute, and by the way, the Karolinska Institute in Sweden is one of the most respected in the world. They have a study called Fruit and Vegetable-Rich Diets Linked to a Much Lower Risk of Chronic Lung Disease. Quote, a diet rich in fruit and vegetables is linked to a significant lower risk of developing chronic lung disease and in former smokers. So if you know anyone who has been a smoker, the more fruit and vegetable and juices you get into their body, the healthier they're going to be. That's the latest on health and healing. I'm Gary Nall. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Dream love. Nice to have you with us, everyone, from all over the world. I want to thank all the different radio stations for carrying this program for so long. This is the longest-running health program in the world history. More people have listened to this program than Carlton Frederick's show, Adele Davis's, or any other person ever alive. And we're just getting started. So I want to thank all those people for being on board. More information on the environmental issues than any program in history, on nutrition, on alternative healing, and on anti-aging. So people are interested. But they're also interested in other topics as well, especially it's nice to be healthy. It's nice to know that you can be vital. But what happens if the society you're living in is not healthy or vital? What if it's corrupted? What if there is a slow and creeping form of totalitarianism, fascism, police state? That's also important. We have to look up and look around. Otherwise, we won't have the freedoms. We wouldn't be able to eat our organic. It would all be GMO. We wouldn't be able to advocate healthy natural treatments for other people. It would all be a medical industrial complex that looks at people like myself and others as a threat. After all, every person that listens to my advice and gets healthier is a person less likely to take an unnecessary dangerous medication often, and that takes money out of the medical industrial complex. Now, it may seem insignificant, and probably it is, but keep in mind, they're making $3.5 trillion a year, and it's not enough. They still want more, and they still feel threatened by people making healthy choices for themselves. So I'm one of those big believers in freedom of choice. In a few moments, the illusion of freedom in the police state is live and well, John Whitehead. But now we're going to go over, and we're going to hear from two people right now. First up, a short comment from Glenn Greenwald on the BBC, talking about the CIA. This is the agency that people seem to have a lot of respect for. Maybe you ought to do some homework if you respect the CIA.
So the CIA is an agency that has repeatedly got caught lying in the past. It's designed to disseminate propaganda. And they're currently in open warfare with the person who was just elected president of the United States. They were behind Hillary Clinton's campaign. So I agree that once the CIA briefs the president and president-elect on this document, it becomes newsworthy to report that fact. But the mere fact that the CIA tried to enshrine this document in a cloud of authenticity or credibility doesn't, for me as a journalist, convince me at all that the claims are true. I want to see evidence first to believe that the claims are true.
Hang on a second. Whatever they tell him now, he would have to take with a pinch of salt because he would see them as a partisan organization. Is that what you're essentially suggesting?
I would say that any rational human being with even minimal history of the United States and the CIA would take everything that the CIA says with a huge grain of salt. I would call it actually a dose of rational skepticism, given how many times in the past that agency has lied and been in error. You know, of course, don't you, that the Iraq War was started because that agency said that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction and was in an alliance with Al-Qaeda, something that turned out to be tragically untrue.
So, of course,
people would treat those claims skeptically.
Okay.
All right. And I'm glad to hear, and I'm respectful of the fact that Glenn Greenwald came out and challenged the CIA. You do not see that being done by a whole lot of other organizations or people because they can fight back, and they do it in a dirty way. I just want to put this in proper perspective, though. We have a governmental agency that I believe should be completely disbanded. It is a rogue state to itself. Why? Let's be very specific and documentable. They have sold weapons to the Iranians in the 1980s at a markup cost to support the overthrow of the Nicaraguan government. That's been proven. Cocaine trafficking into the United States, fueling the crack cocaine epidemic, and generating billions for covert operations. That's been proven. Military aircraft illegally obtained from the Air Force's boneyard in Arizona for gun renting and drug smuggling. Again proven. Aero Air 1285, a chartered military aircraft blown up in Gander, Newfoundland, killing 256 million Americans to prevent the leaking to the media of an aborted covert mission to destroy an Iraqi nuclear weapons research facility with a nuclear backpack. Arrow Air was used in gun running to the Contras. The murder of Colonel James Sabo at the MCAS El Toro Air Force Base. Why? Because he uncovered the gun running, he uncovered the cocaine dealing, he was going to be a whistleblower, and they killed him. And I, by the way, his brother is a respected surgeon, and he and I spoke, and I did an investigation on it and wrote an article on it. It's somewhere in our archives. I have about 780 articles I've written. That's one of them. Also, there was an intelligence-related assassination cell concealed within the Pentagon and Department of Defense, which murders not enemy agents, but rather anyone that represents a threat to exposing illegal covert operations. These are some of the things we know about. But did you know also, and these are all historically documented, 1948 in Italy, the CIA corrupts democratic elections in Italy, where Italian communists threatened to win the elections and would have. So the CIA buys votes, broadcasts propaganda, threatens and beats up opposition leaders, and infiltrates and disrupts their organizations. And it works. The democratically would have been elected communists don't win. Now, I am not a supporter of communism. I think it's abhorrent on many levels. But the fact is that we are interfering in democratic processes because we want our people in there. 1953, one of the classic examples, the CIA overthrows the democratically elected government of Mohammad Mossadegh in a military coup, and after he threatened to nationalize British oil, and the CIA replaces him with a dictator, the Shah of Iran, who got only good press in the United States from Life magazine, Time magazine, all the media. They loved the Shah and his family. But they didn't ask about SAVAK, S-A-V-A-K, his brutal Gestapo-like organization that caused the death, murder of tens of thousands of Iranian citizens. And then in 1954 in Guatemala, the CIA overthrows the democratically elected government in a military coup. Arbenz had threatened to nationalize the Rockefeller-owned United Fruit Company, in which the CIA director Alan Dulles also owned stock. Arbenz was replaced by right-wing dictators whose policies would end up killing over 100,000 Guatemalans over the next 40 years. So one single coup, Guatemala, and you can verify this in government documents and Freedom of Information Act and declassified information, and John Perkins, who was on this program, who I interviewed specifically about Arbenz, and said, did all this happen to your personal experience? He said, yes. And it would work this way. CIA operatives would go into a country and say, we're willing to work with you. We'll see that you stay in power. There won't be any effort to overthrow you. But in return, we want these concessions. We want to privatize this. We want to own that. We'll share with you. You can have all the money you can steal. And if a person went along with it, good. If they didn't, then the jackals came in. The jackals killed them. And that's how it's worked for a long time. The CIA is behind all that. In 1959 in Haiti, the U.S. military helps Papadoc Duvalier become dictator of Haiti. And his notorious Tonton Macoutes terrorized and murdered over 100,000 people. So now we got 100,000 Guatemala, and 100,000 is adding up. So 200,000 dead because of the CIA. Then you got 1961, the Dominican Republic. The CIA assassinates Rafael Trujillo, and then Ecuador in 1961. They backed a CIA-backed military coup to throw out of office the democratically elected president, Jose Velasco, and they got his puppet in his place. And 1963, it was the Dominican Republic. The CIA overthrows the democratically elected of Juan Bosch in military coup and installs a repressive right-wing group. Ecuador, in the same year, CIA-backed military coup overthrows president. In 64, in Brazil, CIA military coup overthrows the democratically elected government of Goulart. And And it took 20 years before there'd be any change. It was all blood and battle at that time. In 1965, in Indonesia, the CIA overthrows the democratically elected Sukarno and replaces it with Suharto, and that caused 1 million deaths. In Dominican Republic in 65 also, a popular rebellion breaks out, promising to reinstall Juan Bosch as the country's elected leader, and the revolution is crushed by the U.S. Marines and the land to uphold the military regime by force. And the CIA was directing the whole thing. In Greece, the same year, the CIA backing the king removes George Papandreou as prime minister, and Papandreou had failed to vigorously support U.S. interests, so he had to go. Same year in the Congo, Zaire now, the CIA-backed military coup installs Mobutu Sese Seko, and he was a massively corrupt dictator. And then you have 1967 in Greece, again a CIA military coup, then 70 in Cambodia, 71 in Bolivia, 73 in Chile, 75 in Australia, 75 in Angola, and interesting because in Angola, it was eager to demonstrate America's military resolve after its defeat in Vietnam, so Henry Kissinger launches a CIA-backed war in Angola. And contrary to Kissinger's assertions, Angola is a country of little strategic importance and not seriously threatened by communism. Well, the CIA backs the brutal leader of UNITAS, Jonathan Savimbi, and this polarizes Angola politics and drives his opponents into the arms of Cuba and the Soviet Union for survival. And Congress would cut off the funds in 1976, but the CIA was able to run the war off the books until 1984. So for 9 years, they had this whole war going on. And in 79 in El Salvador and Nicaragua in 79 and 80 El Salvador, 86 Haiti again, and 89 Panama, 90 Haiti, and 91 Gulf War. These are all CIA operations. So just understand that when someone says, well, you know, the CIA, we need them. No, we don't. They're a criminal organization. And it was an understatement what the respected Glenn Greenwald had to say on it. Those are my thoughts. Now, let's hear from a person who, if he were sitting down with Donald Trump and saying, Donald, I know you don't like to read, not even a paragraph, but you better understand the history of Israel before you align yourself with the policies of Netanyahu. And Netanyahu does not represent all of the people of Israel. There's a vital and vibrant peace movement at all levels of the Israeli society. We just never hear about it in the highly censored American media. Here's what this man might have to say that might give Donald a moment of pause, even in his hyperkinetic mindset.
As you say, George, I grew up a supporter of the State of Israel. I was brought up as a Zionist. I went to Israel again and again and again on holiday. I had family there. I had friends there. But as I traveled around, because it's a small area, I would see not just Israelis in Israel living in huge comfort, subsidized by the Americans. I would see settlers in the illegal settlements living in huge comfort. And minutes away, I would go to a Palestinian township or village and see sewage flowing through the streets. And if you have any sense of justice at all, and as a Jewish child I was brought up with a sense of justice, the disparity is unacceptable. And it's got worse. It's got worse and worse and worse the whole time. And the Israelis live in comfort. I've gone through Tel Aviv and see them sitting at their pavement cafes, complacently enjoying themselves, while hardly any distance away, people in the Gaza Strip are living in total misery. But don't let's forget the people on the West Bank. They're living in misery as well. A huge difference between the apartheid that the Israelis are inflicting on the Palestinians and the loathsome and odious apartheid that existed in South Africa. There were distances, considerable distances, between Johannesburg, Cape Town, Durban, and the South African, townships. In Palestine, it's minutes between the settlements or between Israel behind the 67 borders and the hell that they've created in Gaza and on the West Bank. So it's worse even than the foul actions of the South African apartheid government. You've got to make these people feel it. I'm not optimistic, but I'm realistic. Nobody ever expected the Soviet Union to collapse in the way that it did, but it happened. Nobody ever expected apartheid in South Africa to collapse in the way that it did, but it happened.
What we need
and what I press for and will go on pressing for is governments, the United Nations, the European Union, the United States, our own country, to impose economic sanctions so that the Israelis can feel what international opinion means. There's no point in condemning them. There's certainly no point in appealing to their better nature because they don't have a better nation. You've got to make them suffer because that's the only way they will feel anything. And economic sanctions would erode this huge first world standard of living which they enjoy on borrowed money.
On a recent summer,
because there wasn't enough electricity for air conditioning in nearby Tel Aviv, they cut off the electricity in the Gaza Strip, and Qatar had to intervene and see what it could do, which wasn't enough. No building materials are brought in, so that the schools that the Israelis destroyed, in some cases with children in them, cannot be rebuilt. Medical facilities are at their minimum. If any other country on earth was doing what the Israelis have been doing to 1.7 million Palestinians in Gaza, there will be United Nations resolutions, there will be calls for intervention, there will be sanctions, but the Israelis literally get away with
and
murder. Every politician pretty well in the United States yields to the Jewish pressure groups, and that's why they daren't do anything about it, even if they wanted to do something about it. The European Union is inactive. The British government is inactive. The Prime Minister, David Cameron, described the Gaza Strip as a prison camp. Most of my parents' families, because my parents came here as refugees, most of my parents' families were murdered in the Holocaust. When the Germans came to the town from which my mother came in Poland, Staszów, they lined up all the Jews to march to the railway station to be put in cattle wagons. But for those who were not well enough to march, they killed them on the spot. And they killed my grandmother, who was ill in bed, by shooting her in her bed. My grandmother did not die to provide cover for Israelis murdering Palestinian grandmothers.
That's one man's view. That is, a person who has had a long and productive life supporting Israel, Sir Gerald Kaufman, Member of Parliament, and also knighted and a great humanitarian. Whether you agree or disagree with him, it's a voice we do not hear in the mainstream media. Also, what we do not hear are prophetic words from the people from other countries looking at America and asking, what are we doing? But one such person in the United States who's doing a lot of good is John Whitehead. I have a lot of respect for John. I'm going to quote something. I'd like to see if anyone in the audience knows who the quote is from. If you do, please call 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. Here's the quote. What happened here was the gradual habituation of the people, little by little, to being governed by surprise, to receiving decisions deliberated in secret, to believing that the situation was so complicated that the government had to act on information which the people would not understand, or so dangerous that even if the people could understand it, it could not be released without because of national security. This separation of government from people, this widening of the gap, took place so gradually and so insensibly, each step disguised, perhaps not even intentionally, as a temporary emergency measure or association with true patriotic allegiance or with real social purpose, and all the crisis and reforms so occupied the people that they did not see the slow motion underneath of the whole process of government growing remoter and remoter. Question is, who said that? If you know, think you know, please let us know. I'd like to hear that, your answer. There is something being concocted in the dens of power, far beyond the public eye, and it doesn't bode well for the future of this country. That's my opinion. Anytime we have an entire nation so mesmerized by the antics of the political ruling class that they are oblivious to all else, you'd better be aware. Anytime you have a government that operates in the shadows, that speaks in a language of force, that rules by fiat, you'd better be beware. And anytime you have a government so far removed from its people as to ensure that they are never seen, heard, or heeded by those elected to represent them, you'd better beware. When was the last time you heard anyone from the government going into the small communities like Dayton, Ohio, Akron, Ohio, going down some of the streets that may only have one or two people living in homes, possibly they're old and cannot move or choose not to, and the rest of the entire area that was once vital to America and the world's interests, manufacturing things, closed up. Those companies had been researched, seeing that they were vulnerable, they were purchased, and then they were assets stripped off, and then what they actually produced was sent overseas. You haven't heard from that. That's what I mean by saying that they were invisible. Well, as historian Milton Mayer recounts in his seminal book on Hitler's rise to power, they thought they were free. Quote, most of us did not want to think about fundamental things and never did. There was no need to. Nazism gave us some dreadful fundamental things to think about. We were decent people and kept us so busy with continuous changes and crisis and so fascinated by the machinations of the national enemies within and without that we had no time to think about these dreadful things that were going little by little all around us. We are at that most vulnerable point right now. The gravest threat facing us, again, in my opinion, as a nation, is not extremism delivered by way of sovereign citizens or radicalized Muslims, but by despotism exercised by a ruling class whose only allegiance is to power and money. America's burning, not visibly, not externally, at its core, at its heart, and most Americans can do at this moment is to switch the channel, tune out what they don't want to hear, and tune into their own personal echo chambers. I believe we are living in a national state of denial, and yet no amount of escapism can shield us from the harsh reality that the danger in our midst is posed by an entrenched government bureaucracy that has no regard for the Constitution, Congress, the Bill of Rights, or the courts, or even the citizens. If the team colors have changed from blue to red, Please understand that's just cosmetic. The playbook remains the same. The leopard has not changed its spots. Scrape off the surface layers and you'll find that the American police state is alive and well, continuing to wreak havoc on the rights of American people. We the people are no longer living the American dream. We're living a lie. Indeed, Americans have been lied to so sincerely, so incessantly, and for so long by politicians of all stripes who lie compulsively and without any seeming remorse that they've almost come to prefer the lies trotted out by those in government over less palatable truths. The American people have become compulsive believers. As Nick Cohen writes in The Guardian, compulsive liars shouldn't frighten you. They can harm no one. If no one listens to them, compulsive believers, on the other hand, they should terrify you. Believers are the liar's enablers. Their votes give the demagogue his power. Their trust turns the charlatan into the president. Their credulity ensures that the propaganda of half-calculating and half-mad fanatics has the power to change the world. And while telling the truth in a time of universal deceit, as George Orwell concluded, the revolutionary act, believing the truth and being able to distinguish the truth from the lie, today is a revolutionary act. So here's a truth few Americans want to acknowledge. Nothing has changed. Nothing for the better since Barack Obama passed the reins of the police state to Donald Trump. The police state is still winning. We are losing. In fact, the American police state has continued to advance at the same costly, intrusive, privacy-sapping, constitutional-defying, relentless pace under President Trump as it did under Obama. Police have not stopped disregarding the rights of citizens. Having been given the green light to probe, poke, pinch, taser, search, seize, strip, shoot, generally manhandle anyone they see fit to and in any circumstances, all with the general blessing of the courts, America's law enforcement officials are no longer mere servants of the people entrusted with keeping the peace. Indeed, they continue to keep the masses corralled, under control, and treated like suspects and enemies rather than citizens. SWAT teams have not stopped crashing through doors and terrorizing families. Nationwide, SWAT teams continue to be employed to address an astonishingly trivial array of criminal activities or more mere community nuisances, including angry dogs or domestic disputes and improper paperwork filed by an orchid farmer and a misdemeanor marijuana possession. 80,000 SWAT team raids carried out every single year on unsuspecting Americans for relatively routine police matters and federal agencies laying claim to their own law enforcement dividends. The Pentagon and the Department of Homeland Security have not stopped militarizing federal and federalizing local police. Police forces continue to be transformed into heavily armed extensions of the military, complete with jackboots, helmets, shields, batons, pepper spray, stun guns, assault rifles, body armor, miniature tanks, and weaponized drones. In training police to look like and act like military and use the weapons and tactics of war against American citizens, the government continues to turn the United States into a battleground. Schools have not stopped treating young people like hardcore prisoners. School districts continue to team up with law enforcement to create a schoolhouse to jailhouse track by imposing a double dose of punishment for childish infractions, suspension or expulsion from school accompanied by arrest by the police and a trip to a juvenile court. For-profit private prisons have not stopped locking up Americans and immigrants alike at taxpayers' expense. Censorship has not stopped. First Amendment activities continue to be pummeled, punched, kicked, choked, chained, and generally gagged all across the country. The reasons for such censorship vary widely, from political correctness and safety concerns and bullying to national security and hate crimes, but the end result remains the same. The complete eradication of what Benjamin Franklin referred to as the principal pillar of a free government. The courts have not stopped marching in lockstep with the police state. The courts continue to be dominated by technicians and statists who are deferential to authority, whether government or business. Indeed, the Supreme Court's decision in recent years have most often been characterized by an abject deference to government authority, military, and corporate interest. Government bureaucrats have not stopped turning American citizens into criminals. The average American now unknowingly commits 3 felonies a day, thanks to an overabundance of vague logs that render otherwise innocent activity illegal, while reinforcing the power of the police state and its corporate allies. The surveillance stop has not stopped spying on Americans' communications, transactions, and movements. On any given day, whether you're walking through a store, driving your car, checking email, or talking to friends and family on the phone, you can be sure that the government agencies are listening to everything and watching everything you do. The TSA has not stopped groping and ogling travelers. Congress has not stopped enacting draconian laws such as the USA Patriot Act and the National Defense Authorization Act. These laws, which completely circumvent the rule of law and the constitutional rights of citizens, continue to reorient our legal landscape in such a way as to ensure that martial law, rather than the rule of law, or the U.S. Constitution, becomes the map by which we navigate life in the United States. The Department of Homeland Security has not stopped being a wasteful, growing, fear-mongering beast. The deep state shadow government has not stopped calling the shots behind the scenes. The military-industrial complex has not stopped profiting from endless wars abroad, costing us approximately $15 billion a month or $20 million an hour. Not a penny of that going for infrastructure, for the health and well-being of the American citizens. America has not stopped as a people being gullible, just like sheep. In fact, many Americans have been so carried away by their blind, rank-and-file partisan devotion, either to the left or to the right, both of which are completely corrupted. They look at these as respected institutions. They are not. They are soiled beyond belief, both the Democratic and Republican institutions. We, the people, become so trusting and gullible, so easily distracted, so out of touch, and so sure of our government, or the partisans that we support will always do the right thing by us. Will they? They never do the right thing by us. Unfortunately, once a free people allows the government to make inroads into their reform of their freedoms, or uses those same freedoms as bargaining chips for security, it quickly becomes a slippery slope to outright tyranny. Where do I believe we are today? We are in the midst of the silent coup of America. And all the while, Americans are asking for their next beer and chips. I'm Gary Knoll. And let's go over and say hello real quick. We have Sophie from Connecticut. Sophie, what's the answer?
Well, I had called in, Gary, because I spotted that quote from Orwell that you said, call in if you know who this is, you know.
So, okay, yes, no, it wasn't for Orwell, but thank you for calling in. Mark from Denver, Colorado. Mark?
Yes, sir. Milton Mayer, a journalist out of Chicago, they thought they were free.
You are absolutely correct. It was based upon the Germans, 1933. That's what he was referring to.
Exactly.
Thank you, Mark from Denver. And Bill from Georgia, I'm hopeful that you would have gotten it. And Randolph from Montreal, I want to thank you all for calling in. I'm Gary Knoll. We're out of time. Have a nice day, everyone.